The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
There was a reason that so many generals said yes to this kind of job, either retired or acting, because not only was it a sense of duty, which, I mean, John Kelly has said if Hillary Clinton offered him a job, he would have taken it. So certainly a sense of duty is important, but also they thought Obama had failed in not in significant areas in the Middle East. Whether it was not enforcing the red line in Syria, whether it was pulling out of Iraq in 2011, whether it was signaling the withdrawal date from Afghanistan on December 1st, 2009, when President Obama, you know, announced the surge in Afghanistan. So these are substantive policy differences that they came into office thinking that Obama had failed in certain ways, and none of them were in love with the Iran deal. Although, you know, they thought it could have been improved. And John Kelly, by the way, had, I think, substantive disagreements with the Obama administration on an issue when he was running Southern Command, which was the Obama administration wanted to close Guantanamo. So there were substantive policy differences, I think, that also explain why they were willing to take these jobs, in addition to the fact that the duty calls and they were being asked to serve.
I'm David Priest, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, December 17th, 2019. You probably know Peter Bergen from his work at CNN, his books on terrorism and national security, or perhaps even his role as vice president at New America. Now, he's turned his reporting and analysis to President Trump, to President Trump's advisors, and to the impact of those relationships on U.S. national security. I spoke with Peter in the New Jungle Studio about his new book, Trump and His Generals, about the president's confusing mix of attraction to senior military leaders and disdain for their advice, and what it all means for foreign policy in Washington. It's the Lawfare Podcast, Peter Bergen, on Trump and His Generals. Peter, you've written books before about al-Qaeda and terrorism, about the ideology of terrorism, the strategy, counterterrorism strategy and operations. Why turn to a book that's a Washington insider account of the president and his national security team?
You know, this book initially started, I thought I was going to write a book about the campaign against ISIS. And a friend of mine said, you know, you should really write about Trump. When he got elected, and I thought that was an interesting idea. And I've been living in Washington for 2.5 decades, and I know a lot of people in the national security apparatus, and I thought this would be an interesting tale.
And that it is. You didn't limit yourself to ISIS, but ISIS does come up in the book. When you moved to other topics, did you find that having worked on the terrorism projects for 2 decades – gave you insight into where to go with the interviews to draw out some of the amazing anecdotes you found?
Well, yeah, my area of expertise, you know, has taken me to Afghanistan a lot, to Saudi Arabia a lot, to Iraq a fair amount, and also to Qatar. Mm-hmm. And these are some of the key countries that are and foreign policy issues that are discussed in the book. So I was able to, in fact, I was in Afghanistan last week. I think that's helpful because, you know, this is not the sort of me sitting at my desk in Washington and only talking to people in Washington. I've, you know, gone to the places where these events are happening, have a sense of how they played out on the ground.
Mm-hmm. You really point out a contrast here. You point out that no other president has had so many generals in top civilian positions. And at the same time, no other president has so consistently demeaned or dismissed them and their advice. Talk through that a little bit, the dynamic of wanting the generals and what you call the fruit salad on their lapels to back up the president who has no prior military experience or political office. And on the other hand, in his sessions with those generals, not really deferring to their expertise on their matters that they've worked on in many cases for full careers.
Yeah, I mean, as you said, this is the first American president who neither served in the military nor had political office. And so, I mean, he needed to understand how the levers of national security power worked. And also, because of the Never Trumpers, you know, the 100-plus Republican national security heavyweights who'd signed the two Never Trump letters, the pool from which he could recruit was pretty small. And in fact, if you think about the uniformed military, obviously would never sign a Never Trump letter. And most retired generals, four-star, you know, the higher-ranking ones, wouldn't have signed these letters either. So by default, the pool became these four-star, three-star generals, retired or serving. And Trump himself had attended a military-style boarding school, which seemed to have had quite a lot of impact on the way he thought about the military. You know, so this is the pool he recruited. And one of the things I say in the book, I mean, I think Mike Flynn, who obviously, you know, had his own problems pretty quickly within the administration, Mike Flynn was absolutely critical to Trump early on, because when you're electing a president, you're also electing the commander in chief. And, you know, whatever your views about Hillary Clinton, the fact that, you know, she was well qualified as commander in chief. She had advised to, you know, do the bin Laden raid when she was sitting in the Obama Situation Room. She'd obviously served as Secretary of State. She'd been a fairly senior senator. So
one does not need to subscribe to President Obama's glowing endorsement of her as the most qualified candidate ever, which is a disservice to people like James Monroe and George H.W. Bush, to admit that, yes, in fact, she was qualified for the job based on experience.
Well qualified. So Steve Bannon said to Donald Trump, you know, we need to kind of get you across the finish line on the commander-in-chief issue. Mm-hmm. And one way that happened was Mike Flynn, a highly decorated, you know, war hero from the Afghan and Iraq wars, a three-star general, you know, played a very critical role in Trump's campaign and then became his first national security advisor. And then, of course, Trump also hired, you know, Jim Mattis as Secretary of Defense, John Kelly as the Secretary of Homeland Security, and H.R. McMaster as his second national security advisor. What's interesting about all these people is they'd never met Trump. I mean, John Kelly has said that not only he'd never met Trump, he didn't know anybody who knew Trump. So, I mean, this was like they were from this totally different ecosystem, and then they were brought into the White House. And Trump, I think Trump listened to them about some things. I mean, he didn't pull out of the Iran nuclear deal for 18 months. It was only when John Bolton came in that within a week, you know, he obviously wanted to pull out of the deal, but he kept pulled back by Jim Mattis, who said, look, the deal is kind of working. It may not be perfect. It was negotiated with our allies, the English, French, and the Germans. We stand by our word when we make these agreements. And on Afghanistan, he did listen to them. I mean, at the end, it was a very messy. I detail in the book how, you know, there were brutal knockdown fights between, on the one hand, Steve Bannon, who led the America First wing of the party, and on the other hand, H.R. McMaster, who led the so-called globalist element of the party. And H.R. suffered, you know, I quote somebody in the book who said H.R. took a lot of face shots in this, because it was ultimately the Pentagon and other people in the national security establishment took H.R.'s position. But it was H.R. who was doing all the frontline, you know, kind of. And I think over time, that was one of the reasons that H.R. was sort of basically forced out early, was this, you know, the Trump hates being managed, and he felt he was being managed on this issue.
Absolutely. Let's take a step back and walk through each of these choices that you mentioned for the four generals that you focus on the most. Let's start with Michael Flynn. In a sense, he's the easiest because he felt so aggrieved at the Obama administration, both on policy, but also on the way that he was removed from his job at the Defense Intelligence Agency. And he became a robust supporter of the president in the campaign, appearing at rallies and things like that. But even when he started on the job with that connection with Trump that the others really didn't have, it didn't seem to go well. Describe what happened at the National Security Council when he was asked to describe to the staff the America First strategy and what it meant.
Yeah, that's a great scene, which I'd almost forgotten until you reminded me, which is, so it's in front of a couple of hundred plus staffers who work on the National Security Council, and it's the first all-staff meeting that Mike Flynn, and the last one he had. And he's asked by somebody, what is the America First strategy? And there's kind of a long pause, and the couple hundred plus senior civil servants who largely make up the National Security Council realized that Mike Flynn wasn't going to be able to answer this question. And afterwards, he turned to Katie McFarland, who was then the deputy national security advisor, and said, kind of, do you have an answer to this? So So Flynn, I don't think Flynn, he just hadn't really thought through kind of what it meant to be the national security advisor. He did now, in his defense, he did hire some pretty impressive people. He hired Fiona Hill, who of course is the senior Russia expert on the council. He hired Derek Harvey, Joel Rayburn, Mike Bell, all of whom are, you know, PhD, you know, kind of academic, but also colonel level serving or recently retired military officers who'd all been sort of proteges of David Petraeus in Iraq. And also he hired Matt Pottinger, who is, of course, the China, the main China expert. So, you know, he did hire some good people. He also hired some pretty bad people like Sebastian Gorka, who, you know, it was never really clear to anybody at the White House what exactly Sebastian was doing except going on television.
Right. So he left. But before then, we had a couple of other generals come in. Talk through Trump's search for a Secretary of Defense. Mattis wasn't even close to his first choice, right?
Yeah. And, you know, it's interesting. I think this is one of the news nuggets in the book, which is that the first person to be tapped was General Stanley McChrystal, who on November 16th, 2016, got a call from the Trump, you know, essentially Trump Tower, where all the decisions were being made during the transition, saying, we'd like to consider you for we're very interested in you being Secretary of Defense. Now, McChrystal is very close to Mike Flynn, who Mike Flynn was, of course, the de facto leader of the national security team during the transition. They had, you know, spent years fighting together, burying people together, celebrating, you know, marriage anniversaries together. They knew each other very well. But Stan McChrystal said, look, I just basically don't want the job. And the reason he thought that Trump was ignorant, he thought that Trump was not going to be a good commander in chief, and he turned it down. Mm-hmm. And then the next person to turn it down was Jack Keane, who I characterize in the book as sort of a shadow national security advisor to Trump, both on Fox News and also privately in the Oval Office. Jack Keane's wife had had Parkinson's for the past 15 years, and she'd recently died, and he just basically said, I don't want the job. He was also offered the job again after Jim Mattis was resigned. And then finally, you know, came to Mattis himself, who was at a food bank volunteering when he got a call from Vice President-elect Pence, who said, we'd like you to come in and talk to us about Secretary of Defense. And Mattis says, I'm in the middle of this food bank stuff. Can I call you back? Which is kind of
shows his priorities, doesn't it?
Yeah. It's kind of a – but he, you know, 2 days later, he's out at Bedminster and they sit down. And actually, interestingly, they have this – Trump and Mattis have this interesting discussion, which is sort of misreported at the time. Trump says, you know, we should torture terrorists. And Mattis says, you know, it's better if you just have a conversation. And the way it was misreported at the time, and give them a beer. Well, of course, you can't give a jihadi terrorist
coffee
beer.
And cigarettes.
Coffee and cigarettes is what he actually said. They also had Mattis basically said, look, if NATO didn't exist, you'd have to invent it because it's been so helpful to us as a country. And of course, that particular discussion over time.
It was a harbinger of things to come.
It was a harbinger of things to come. But yeah, it was really a romance at the beginning. You know, the day that Trump is inaugurated, he actually – there's a lunch up on Capitol Hill and he picks Mattis out of a crowd and says, you know, he's so great and he's out of central casting and it's going to be great. But this thing soured pretty quickly. And it soured, I think a small part of it was the way that Trump conducts himself, because obviously in the military is an honor-based culture. And Trump, even his defenders would probably concede he's not really an honorable gentleman. But really it became about policy, and particularly the question of treatment of NATO, his bromance with Putin, trying to get out of Afghanistan, trying to get out of Syria. So, I mean, these policy issues really began to add up, particularly for Mattis.
And in another way, that Capitol Hill meeting really was telling, because the president said the quiet thing out loud, which is he was picking people for jobs in part based on how they looked and how they sounded. Maybe that's why General Keane was considered, although one might argue that he's had greater influence on the president by talking on Fox News than he would have if he were representing the interest of the Defense Department to the president, which is where a lot of these clashes have occurred.
I don't disagree with that. I mean, I think Jack Keane, by appearing on Fox, I mean, there's a scene in the book where Keane says, look, if we want to send a signal to the North Koreans, let's make South Korea a family-only, you know, no family post, meaning that if the 25,000 or so American soldiers should basically, their family should be evacuated. And of course, this causes a lot of consternation at the White House because Trump says, that's what we're going to do. And his advisors say, look, if you want to crash a South Korean stock market, kind of,
You know, because the North Koreans will see that as a precursor to war.
the North Koreans would interpret it as that. And in the end, that didn't happen. But Keane also, you know, has met with Trump in the Oval Office and has talked him off the ledge, for instance, about a precipitate withdrawal from Syria. And what he did was he pulled out a map and he showed Trump on the map, look, this is where the oil fields are. If we leave some troops here, we can kind of make sure that ISIS or Iran doesn't sort of seize them.
The magic words for Trump, right?
Yeah, well, and also, you know, he communicates with Trump in a way that Trump understands it. So he bought a map. He didn't explain this in a sort of set of PowerPoint, you know, long briefing. He showed him on a map what this looked like. And also, Keane says if you bring Trump new information, he'll listen to it. If it's the same old arguments, he'll just tune it out.
Yeah. And he made that clear in comments, I believe, at the end of the campaign, but perhaps right after he took office or the election, saying, I don't like being told the same thing over and over. I want bullet points, not long papers. And woe be anyone who ignored that advice.
Well, and H.R. McMaster told the National Security Council staff, you know, the 70-page briefing paper is not going to cut it. Like, get it on an index card, suggest some tweets. And there's nothing – I mean, there's nothing wrong with any of this. If the president gets the National Security Council staff that he wants – he's the commander in chief. It's his presidency. He's the only person who gets elected in this sort of. So the people around him need to adjust the way that he accepts information, not the other way around.
Right. Let's stick with that for a minute on McMaster, but go back a little bit. It was about a month into the administration when Michael Flynn stepped aside, was booted out the door, and a new national security advisor was needed. Describe the H.R. McMaster interview at Mar-a-Lago.
Well, there were three candidates at the time, four candidates. One was General Castlin, who was the commandant at West Point. He came in looking like Clint Eastwood in his dress uniform. There was John Bolton, who basically Trump said, look, John, you know, we can't constantly be going to war all over the world. Right. And there was also Keith Kellogg, who was kind of the acting national security advisor, retired three-star general. And there was HR. Now, HR obviously is, you know, one of the stars of his generation in terms of, you know, his intellect, his PhD, his book Dereliction of Duty, his Silver Star in Iraq, you know, his campaign during the first Gulf War, to, you know, still being taught at war colleges about, you know, they destroyed two dozen Iraqi tanks in 23 minutes. And so HR, you know, but at the end of the interview, and it was a relatively brief of 20 minutes. Trump says to Steve Bannon, is H.R. McMaster really a general?
And he still was active military at the time.
Three-star general.
Yes.
And Bannon says, yeah, very much so, Silver Star. And he's like, you know, and Trump says he looks like a beer salesman based on the cut of his suit. But, you know, Trump obviously got over that. But, you know, this is
it's still telling.
It's still telling. And their relationship didn't really, you know, H.R. McMaster is a brilliant guy and a very likable human being. And when he left, he was clapped out of the White House, which is like several hundred members of the White House and National Security Council staff lined the road, that little internal road that is between the White House and the Eisenhower Executive Building. And very like I can't think of any other senior White House official who's had this kind of like departure. People were crying. So I mean, he was really well loved inside the building. But he didn't really connect with Trump. Why, you know, I quote Steve Bannon tells HR at one point, look, Trump is like a game day guy. He does, you know, he's going to be out all night partying. He's going to like read your notes. He's going to kind of get the passing grade on the exam. He doesn't like being lectured. He hates professors. And, you know, I don't know if you can use four-letter words on this program.
You can.
Okay. Well, I'm quoting Bannon directly to HR McMaster. About H.R. McMaster, he was a fucking globalist and professor. This was kind of Bannon's view of McMaster, and I'm sure that colored how Trump dealt with him.
It really raises that fascinating tension of H.R. McMaster. On the one hand, he got the president enough to counsel the National Security Council staff, stick to bullet points, go with index cards, not full pages of paper, suggest tweets. Yeah. Normally, a policy paper would be very much just about the competing options, the risks, the benefits. He said, no. Put in suggested tweets because the president might catch on to that and really latch on to the material better because of it.
Or use the tweets.
Right.
And yeah. I mean, which is, by the way, I think that's good advice.
That's meeting, as we used to say in the intelligence business, that's meeting the customer where they're at. It's not the job of the president to adjust to the staff.
Right.
It's the job of the staff to adjust to the new president. And in this case, McMaster seems to have gotten that and done about as good as anyone could have under those circumstances.
Yes. And also, by the way, ran a very conventional and I mean that in a good sense, National Security Council process, where there were regular meetings, there were paper options, multiple options were presented to the president. This is the Brent Scowcroft model. I think HR did that.
He attempted to do that.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, he also did not cement that relationship one-on-one with the president.
Yeah.
And that whole process can fall apart if it comes down to the National Security Advisor going into the Oval Office or the residence in this administration very often and saying, Mr. President, we've had the process. Here are the options. Let me present them to you. And then it seemed like from the interviews you did that he would revert back to the policy with the president of saying, let me walk you through these in depth, which just
right.
doesn't work for the president, in a sense, violating his own advice.
Yeah, I mean, that's a puzzle. And I think, I mean, quite a number of people told me in various different ways that was the case, that somehow HR wasn't connecting. The other thing HR didn't do, for very honorable reasons, he didn't go to Mar-a-Lago and like hang out with the president. He didn't go to Bedminster and hang out with the president. And that kind of FaceTime, a lot of people were trying to, during that time period, were trying to just hang out and be with the president. And HR thought his job was to manage the paper flow,
sure.
run the process, and that he wasn't going to do those. But it turned, I mean, anyway, it clearly didn't work in the end. I mean, I think HR had wanted to stay until August of 2018. And in the end, he was out in late April of 2018, and John Bolton was in.
Someone else who we haven't talked about yet in depth, the third general, if you will, at the time of the administration's beginning, was John Kelly, formerly of SOUTHCOM, Southern
yeah.
Command. Now, he had not been pushed out by the Obama administration, so he was different than Michael Flynn.
And even Mattis. Who was
correct.
Kind of had his career ended a few months early because
right.
of his stance on Iran.
So he stands out from the other two. Yet, as you've pointed out, it was even more than that. He was even a degree of separation farther from that because he was not even in communication with people close to Trump. So why was that a match? How did John Kelly come into the administration?
Well, that is a really great question. I mean, look, Jim Mattis and John Kelly are very, very close. If you go back to the invasion of Baghdad in March of 2003, who led the Marines? Jim Mattis. Who was his number two? John Kelly, who got a one-star promotion on the battlefield. And by the way, who was their colonel that they were – it was – one of the colonels was Colonel Fighting Joe Dunford, who of course became chairman. I mean, there's nothing that would bring you together closer than fighting – actually fighting a real war. So these guys were very close. And Mattis was clearly – I mean, some people in the White House always interpreted – Kelly as always being Mattis's deputy, which he'd been when they were in the Marine Corps. And clearly they had a very close relationship. And John Kelly, by the way, had, I think, substantive disagreements with the Obama administration on an issue when he was running Southern Command, which was the Obama administration wanted to close Guantanamo, which they didn't succeed in doing. But, you know, as commander of Southern Command, it was Kelly's job to renovate Guantanamo and kind of keep that running. So even there was substantive disagreements, but not to the degree of what it was with Mike Flynn and Jim Mattis. But there was a reason that so many generals said yes to this kind of job, either retired or acting, because not only was it a sense of duty, which I mean, John Kelly has said if Hillary Clinton offered him a job, he would have taken it. So certainly a sense of duty is important, but also they thought Obama had failed in not insignificant areas in the Middle East, whether it was not enforcing the red line in Syria, whether it was pulling out of Iraq in 2011, whether it was signaling the withdrawal date from Afghanistan on December 1st, 2009, when President Obama announced the surge in Afghanistan. So these are substantive policy differences that they came into office thinking that Obama had failed in certain ways, and none of them were in love with the Iran deal. Although they thought it could be improved, so there were substantive policy differences. I think that also explain why they were willing to take these jobs, in addition to the fact that the duty calls and they were being asked to serve
as Secretary of Homeland Security. I agree. That makes immense sense. And perhaps for a hypothetical President Hillary Clinton, he would have taken the same job at the same time. There's a fundamentally different skill set and mindset that goes into being chief of staff, as Chris Whipple has written excellently about.
Yeah.
And John Kelly decided, yes, I will take that job. And you could see the frustration on his face, most notably at the press conference after the incident in Charlottesville, when John Kelly looked like he would rather be anywhere on earth, perhaps even at Guantanamo, rather than standing there listening to the president.
I think I say he looks like the undertaker at a North Korean state funeral.
Mm. It was not the it did not look like he was enjoying his life at that point.
No, he don't know. The other great scene, which one of my favorite moments in the book, is when they're talking. Trump is talking to the NATO at NATO in Brussels, and at one point, you know, he's sort of berating the Germans and saying you're in the pocket of the Russians. And again, Kelly looks like he'd like to be anywhere else. And Sarah Sanders, who then the White House press secretary, when asked why did Kelly look so uncomfortable, said, "Well, he was expecting a full breakfast and they gave him pastries." Now, the idea that John Kelly somehow
would be so disturbed by the culinary
he's one of the most stoic people in the world would be disturbed by not having the correct breakfast is you know.
Let's talk about a couple of other players here, not the generals, but they fill out the story and then we'll move to some specific vignettes.
Yeah.
Someone that did not get it with the president ever was Rex Tillerson. You note that Jared Kushner had said that Rex Tillerson was Trump's best cabinet choice, which did not look good in retrospect.
Yeah.
How did the chief executive officer of Exxon end up as the Secretary of State?
Well, that is a really interesting set of because Dave Petraeus, obviously a retired four-star general, one of the most able military officers of his generation, was being seriously considered. And when he went up to Trump Tower, he blew Trump away. And for good reason, because Dave Petraeus is a brilliant guy who's had a great – I mean, running Central Command, running the CIA. These are really good preparations for knowing how the world actually operates. But John Kelly and Jim Mattis both nixed him. And they nixed him because for them, the fact that Dave Petraeus had handed over classified information to his biographer, Paula Broadwell, was just – a no-go. And they thought it would be damaging to morale in the armed forces, and they completely blocked it.
That's an interesting case study, isn't it? Because neither Mattis nor Kelly had a close personal relationship with the president, and yet the president went with their advice.
Well, but he went with their advice because he didn't have any – I mean, this was clearly something that they strongly felt, and it's not like the president had a huge amount of I mean, here are two four-star Marine generals retired saying that this is unacceptable. And so then Bob Gates comes in.
Which is a bit of a surprise too, given the rhetoric in the campaign and in the transition against the establishment, because there are few people who are more establishment than Bob Gates. But he comes into, I think, Trump Tower and has a meeting with the president. And how does that lead to Rex Tillerson?
Well, Bob Gates, you know, he's obviously served. He's served in every administration since the Lyndon Johnson administration. He's been Secretary of Defense for Obama and for George W. Bush. You know, he's the leading light of the Republican Party on the issue of national security. So, but Gates says, you know, what you need is somebody with some Hill knowledge, some experience working with the intelligence community, working at the Department of Defense, and people in the room are like, wow, is he putting himself forward for the job? And there's this kind of very long pause, which may last 45 seconds. Trump says absolutely nothing because, you know, and then Gates says, well, of course, I'm not putting myself forward because I've already had enough of these jobs. Mm-hmm. But I will say that Condoleezza Rice and I have been talking about Rex Tillerson. Because Tillerson, you know, he's run one of the world's most successful and largest companies. He's also, you know, got a lot of experience dealing with the Middle East, with Russia, with all these kind of, and so, I mean, on paper, he seemed like a great choice. But my understanding of how Exxon runs versus the State Department is, you know, Exxon, like you're in the God pod, which is where the CEO of Exxon works, and if he directs something, everybody says that it's a private company. Everybody salutes and goes about their job. Now, the State Department doesn't really work like that.
No.
I mean, you kind of these are all these fiefdoms, and you have to kind of bring people along, and it's a different kind of organization. He didn't really. Or my impression, I mean, he only focused on one issue at once. I mean, some of his policy ideas were, I mean, he thought the blockade of Qatar made no sense, which of course it doesn't. He thought, you know, the Iran deal was worth preserving. So on the point on policy, his ideas were pretty sound, but he didn't know how to do more than one thing at once. Mm-hmm. He had a relatively small coterie of people he dealt with. And of course, and he damaged morale at the State Department because he didn't fight back. You know, there was supposed to be a 30% cut. He didn't fight back publicly against that. I mean, he didn't preserve his own department, which is one of the jobs you're supposed to do as the head of the department.
Right. Perhaps it's easy for me to say, but it seems like it would be relatively easy for Rex Tillerson to go to the president early on and say, Mr. President, in order to execute your agenda, in order to make America first everywhere around the world, we can't cut the State Department by 30%. And the president might have responded to that argument better than he would to Rex Tillerson reciting talking points from his policy planning staff, which never seemed to work with Trump.
Yeah, I think in Tillerson's defense, he may have pushed back a bit with Vice President Pence on this issue privately. But I don't know if he ever did it with a president.
Yeah. Let's talk a little bit about the vice president, because at least since the administration of Jimmy Carter, the vice president has been a central figure in national security decision making, some more than others. But it really started with Walter Mondale being included on everything from reading the same copy of the president's daily brief that the president had just seen to being in all of the meetings for decisions. And yet Pence barely appears not only in your narrative, but barely appears in any study of the relationship between Trump and his generals and his other leading national security officials. Where is Mike Pence?
Good question. Well, I mean, you know, an official I spoke to at the White House said Pence only really cared about one national security issue, which is the treatment of Christians, the persecution of Christians in the Middle East. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, he was kind of absent. Now, in his defense, you know, at a certain point, H.R. McMaster, because there was so much disputation about what to do about the Afghan war, and H.R. felt it would be useful if Pence started chairing the meetings where because they needed to come to a decision. And Pence was seen as sort of a fair player. Now, in this meeting, Pence did something pretty unusual, which is he turned to Dan Coats, who was then the director of national intelligence, a longtime colleague and friend of his. They're both conservative Republicans from Indiana, and asked to open the meeting with a prayer. Now, for many of the senior, you know, national security officials, this is kind of a first in the situation.
Not the norm.
Not the norm. Yeah. So on the question of the Afghan war, you know, Pence actually played a pretty good role in terms of kind of forcing a decision to be made. But in general, he's kind of absent from these. He's in a lot of these discussions. He's in the room, but his voice is not something that I found in my interviews would come up. People just didn't really talk about him. And you know, the acting national security advisor, Keith Kellogg, was sort of given this House of Lords position with Pence as his national security advisor. Mm-hmm. They didn't really know what to do with him. Kellogg is long retired and not apparently a particularly impressive national security thinker. Mm-hmm. And so that was regarded as a consolation prize. Right.
So let's talk a bit about how some of these relationships and the lack of relationships here played out in specific cases. One extended story you tell is a momentous briefing in the tank, the big conference room at the Pentagon in July of 2017, with long presentations about the global status of U.S. forces, alliance relationships, and so on. What happened in that meeting, and how did it really illustrate the tension between Trump and his generals?
July 20th, 2017 is really what I think is the most important meeting of the presidency. It's 6 months in. My editor, Scott Moyers at Penguin, said, think about the scene that kind of sets the stage for the book. And this is clearly that scene, because it's where everybody meets to kind of get their own agenda across. On one side, you have Steve Bannon, the leader of the America First wing of the party. Then you have Jim Mattis, Rex Tillerson, who have a very tight relationship, and Gary Cohn, who's the chief economic advisor, and they are arguing for the rules-based international order of the last 70 years and trying to explain to Trump, why do we have 190,000 troops overseas, why these trade treaties benefit us, and like why has this worked mostly in our favor? Mm-hmm. And there are a long set of briefings. Jim Mattis leads on the disposition of troops, some discussion of the nuclear weapons, Rex Tillerson and then Gary Cohn on trade deals and how kind of the trade and national security kind of interact with each other, and like why it's important to keep open the Straits of Malacca, because that's where so much of the Straits of Hormuz.
And all reasonable things to present to a commander in chief, even months into his presidency. But this is not a normal commander in chief.
Yeah, I mean, and they it's like a tutorial, and of course, Trump hates tutorials. He hates being managed, and he was being lectured to. And these are all things he hates. And during these kinds of presentations, he's basically being pretty quiet. And then he just blows up and he starts shouting, you know, various kind of four-letter words and saying, we keep losing these fucking wars. Mm-hmm. And of course, it's General Dunford is in the room, who's been the commander in Afghanistan only until relatively recently. He tells Gary Cohn, you know, I mean, these trade deficits count and the Chinese are fucking us and we're being fucked. And basically the whole thing is a fiasco. And he walks out. And at a certain point, Steve Bannon intervenes. So he's kind of like letting – he's a backbencher. He's not sitting at the table because he's not a cabinet official. And at a certain point, Steve Bannon intervenes and starts shouting at Steve Mnuchin, the Treasury Secretary, saying, look, when we pull out of the Iran deal, which we're going to do, none of these allies are going to be with us. And they're all fair-weather friends and they're protectorates. They're not really allies. And so anyway, so the point of this is that the America First agenda, the pulling back from the world, the – our allies are screwing us. That whole narrative is kind of confirmed by Trump in this meeting in front of all his cabinet. The only person who's missing is H.R. McMaster, who's on a very rare family vacation. But everybody else, even people who are not central players in national security, like Wilbur Ross, the Commerce Secretary, is there. And so he lays down a pretty big marker. And in the car back to the White House, Steve Bannon is in the car with Jared Kushner and then Chief of Staff Ryan Priebus, and he says, this is like Lincoln and his generals, meaning during the Civil War, you know, Lincoln started firing his generals when they weren't basically winning the war. Now, obviously, that was very overwrought. But the point is that this was a signal that, you know, this is the way I got elected on this platform, and this is what I think. I don't care what you think, and I'm not persuaded by these arguments. And in fact, as you know, Trump has been very consistent about this view of that we're being ripped off by our allies. It goes back to that full-page ad he took out in the New York Times in 1987 saying the Japanese and the Saudis are ripping us off and they need to pay down our federal debt. So this idea has been – Trump has been pretty consistent about.
And some of the most compelling stories you bring out from the people who were involved involve the application of that to places like South Korea. In one case, you point out that Trump asked frequently of his advisors things like, do they just pay us for the protection? How do we get reimbursed for this? That kind of thing.
Yeah.
Talk about how that reflected his view and how that played out in the South Korean relationship.
A very consistent theme is this idea of being ripped off. And there's a great scene in the book where Angela Merkel's on her first visit to Washington to meet Trump in the spring of 2017. And Trump is incensed that Germans only spend 1% of their GDP on military spending. By the way, there is kind of a sound historical reason. We don't want a vast German military.
There's a briefing behind that.
But and while the United States pays 4%. Now, Trump either misunderstands how NATO works or either on purpose or he just continues to misunderstand it, because every country pays a small amount to NATO just to kind of maintain itself as an organization. And then they all agree to spend up to 2% of their GDP on their own defense by 2024. Right now, of the 27 countries in NATO, I think 9 do that. So Trump got an invoice kind of made up from Angela Merkel saying that the Germans owed $600 billion. And he gave her the invoice in their first meeting. And Merkel's like, this is not how it works.
You understand this is not real.
This is not real is what she said. Exactly. This is not real. So – but that is the way he thinks. And then South Korea was like Mattis and McMaster dreaded these discussions about the THAAD, the missile system that the United States has put in South Korea, because they Trump was always saying like, let's bill them for this. And they would say, well, the point is that, yeah, we are paying for some of this, but – this is protecting the 200,000 American citizens who live in South Korea. It's not just like we're doing – and also the agreement where we agree to pay for these missiles in South Korea had been negotiated long before these discussions. So anyway, it was one of many things that the Trump administration – that Trump himself, he's very consistent about this idea that other people need to step up. And by the way, he actually had 5 questions that he would ask in every meeting. That, why are we doing this? Can they pay more? What are we paying? You know, how is this in the American interest? I mean, he would ask these very good questions in meetings. And that was, for instance, and on the question on the Afghan war, he'd add another question, was why are we still there 17 years later? These are all great questions. I mean, there's nothing wrong with asking questions and getting other people to step up. But I don't think – I'm on the NATO issue. My back of the envelope suggests that when Trump came into office, 6 countries were paying 2% of their GDP on defense spending. Now they're 9. So it's not like berating these countries has produced – the countries are going to do what's in their own interests.
Right.
And berating them may not be particularly productive.
For me, one of the more fascinating parts about the stories you uncovered is the fact that it adds to what we already have is a robust set of cases whereby senior advisors to the president hear a presidential order and essentially ignore it. You use the kind phrase slow rolling, which happened in some cases is, oh, Mr. President, we'll get you a study on that. And then the study never comes, or they hope that the president's attention moves elsewhere.
Yeah.
This follows up on cases brought up by the anonymous op-ed in The New York Times and now the book, or Bob Woodward's book, Fear.
Yeah.
Cases of things the president orders and those in charge of executing those orders don't do it. That happened with South Korea with, I think you mentioned earlier, the Trump order to evacuate American citizens.
Yeah.
And them saying, oh, we'll put a study together on that. And it just doesn't happen. That's not the way that the executive branch is supposed to function. And yet each of these people feel that they are doing that in the best interest of the United States. What a tension that is.
Yeah, well, and of course, Jim Mattis certainly, I mean, to a fault, I think, did this. He was concerned, I quote him in the book, as saying, yeah, we have to make sure that reason trumps impulse. Hmm. And he saw Trump as a very impulsive guy. And he just basically, when the White House, when Trump and when H.R. McMaster, the National Security Advisor, would ask for military options on Iran, he just wouldn't provide them.
Right.
Or when there was going to be a war game at Camp David about the options in North Korea,
right,
he didn't send war planners. You can't have a war game without the war planners. So this thing just never happened. So that was – but I think Mattis misinterpreted Trump to some degree because he says a lot of stuff, obviously. But is he that impulsive? You know, on Afghanistan, he was actually pretty careful and it took a lot of effort to get him to agree to have a troop increase. On Syria, when ISIS was largely defeated, he wanted to pull back. On Iran, he did have a military option. He pulled it back at the last moment. On North Korea, he's sort of gone out of his way after an initial lot of rhetoric to kind of dial that down. So and you know, in his defense, I mean, just to kind of broaden it out for a minute, Trump has not faced a major national security crisis. There has been no global financial meltdown as there was for Obama. There was no 9/11 as there was for George W. Bush. There was no invasion of Kuwait by Saddam as it was for George H.W. Bush. There was no embassy crisis in Iran as there was for President Carter. There was no invasion of Afghanistan by the Soviets as there was for Ronald Reagan. So he hasn't faced one of these big crises. That said, he also hasn't kind of created a massive crisis of his own, as George W. Bush with the war of choice in Iraq, which, I mean, we all know where that ended. And so he's sort of been lucky there hasn't been a big crisis. On the other hand, he hasn't created a big crisis. The only crisis he's really created to some degree is with the Iranians because they were observing the deal. Now they're enriching uranium, not to any great degree. There could be something with them still where – I mean, what's super interesting to me, go back to this Abqaiq oil attack. I mean, there is no doubt in my mind the Iranians did it. Who has the capacity and also the intent?
It's hard to imagine that in any previous administration, an attack of this scale and scope would, what is it now, 2 months later, be virtually ignored. We've forgotten it.
Forgotten, yeah. Ignored. And you know, and on some levels, good. I mean, you know, this, it turns out the Saudis don't really want a war with Iran. You know, they're perfectly happy having proxy warfare with Iran. Turns out Iran doesn't really want a shooting war. Turns out the United States doesn't really want a shooting war and, you know, we're going to default. There's a lot of commonalities between Obama and Trump. Mm-hmm. One of them is their use of cyber warfare against Iran. Another one, of course, is, you know, no big conventional wars, use of special operations, special forces, use of drones. And that's where the American people are. I mean, whoever the – if, you know, Trump win the second term, I don't think he's going to massively change. And who, if there is only one term, whoever the next president is, he or she – is also going to, I think, follow the Obama-Trump playbook, which is largely this kind of relatively small footprint counterterrorism strategy, no big conventional wars if you can avoid them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. To borrow from H.R. McMaster, if I can, it would be a dereliction of duty on my part not to bring up one of the most shocking stories that you talk about, the April 2017 briefing in the Oval Office on North Korea, when the president is shown a photograph of North Korea, South Korea, and the location of Seoul, the capital of South Korea, with roughly 25 million people in and around the city. What happened?
Okay. Well, this is a fascinating vignette where – so the National Geospatial Agency is known to people on this podcast but not known to most Americans. And it plays a very important role. It played a key role in the bin Laden hunt. They made a model of the Abbottabad compound that was very useful for military planning. And so they brought – they understood that Trump is a visual learner. They brought a model in of a facility, and Trump was very interested in this facility, how well it was defended. And then they showed him the satellite photograph, which is a well-known satellite photograph showing essentially North Korea is completely dark at night. It hasn't the economy doesn't exist. China is ablaze with light, so is South Korea. And as Trump began to focus on the photograph, he was like, why is Seoul so close to the North Korean border? Because he's been briefed repeatedly, if there's a war, millions of people will die in Seoul because they have this huge conventional army, the North Koreans. And then he says they have to move. And now this is 10 million people is the city of Seoul and 25 million people in the metropolitan area. Mm-hmm. And the officials like don't know what to say. I mean, is he joking? And then he says they have to move. And there's – I mean, no, no. People just say – I mean, like this Trump being Trump. It's hard to like know what to say to that. Obviously, it's not a direct order. I mean or not an order that they could enforce even if it was a direct order. So – but this is Trump, and for his supporters, it's like, you know, his out of the box thinking is part of his attraction. For his detractors, his out of the box thinking is just out of the box.
Right. Let's close out with the end story for one of Trump's generals, which is Jim Mattis. Jim Mattis obviously stood there and smiled a lot at things that you've revealed he was arguing against with other advisors and often with the president himself. But eventually, even he broke. What finally broke Mattis, and how did that end?
I think it was a long time coming. He was opposed to the blockade of Qatar. Mm-hmm. Trump had no idea that Qatar housed the most important military base outside the United States, houses campuses for Georgetown, Northwestern, Carnegie. Mm-hmm. You know, if you look at like on paper, Qatar is really should be one of our more close allies in the Gulf. So Mattis went to the mat against that. Mattis also was against Trump, you know, tweeted about the transgenders, sort of saying they can't serve. That was despite the fact Mattis had a study going on about that. You know, the treatment of NATO and our allies. You know, the first thing that Mattis did when he took the job as Secretary of Defense was to call all our allies that day and say, you know, we're with you. And Trump's embrace of Putin, you know, Mattis went to the Reagan Library towards the end of his secretaryship and said, you can't trust Putin. So, I mean, the Syria thing was the occasion, not the cause of, you know, I think that letter of resignation had been brewing in Mattis's mind for some time. And, of course, pulling out, abandoning the Kurds on the battlefield was the final straw for Mattis.
But and I think also how it happened, which is he said, I'm leaving. And we need to uphold our alliance relationships, and I'll stay on until February for a smooth transition. Didn't turn out that way.
Yeah, well, Trump then turned around and said, you're out, you know, at the end of the month. And, and you know,
of course, he didn't do it personally because that's not his style. He tasked, I believe in this case, Mike Pompeo.
Mike Pompeo, yeah. Trump doesn't like tell people directly they're fired. He just gets other people to tell him. So, you know, it was a long time coming, and it will be very interesting when Jim Mattis is once Trump is no longer president. If you look at Mattis's biography, he takes quite a lot of shots at Obama and Joe Biden for their policies in the Middle East. So right now he's not talking about Trump as a sitting president, but it'll be interesting to see what he says.
That's really interesting dynamic to end on is Mattis since then. He's tried to have it in a sense both ways.
Yeah.
He said essentially as a military officer, I should not be commenting on political leadership, although he's willing to do so for past political leaders.
Yeah.
On the other hand, as Secretary of Defense, he is a political appointee of the president, and putting the uniform on when it's convenient to not answer questions. You tell the wonderful story at one of his book parties, how the enterprising Mary Louise Kelly from NPR asked him point blank, what would it take for you to criticize Donald Trump? And he became animated saying, I can't disagree more strongly with former military officers criticizing the president like Mike Flynn and John Allen did. Well, Mattis was not a military officer only. He was the Secretary of Defense. And those are legitimate questions for a former Secretary of Defense.
Yeah. Well, and, you know, the book, in a sense, is a meditation on the question of civil-military relations, which are, you know, it's a very interesting, you know, Dereliction of Duty is obviously an amazing book. And, you know, the generals in Dereliction of Duty didn't do their duty to give the Lyndon Johnson real options about, they told Johnson what he wanted to hear. At the end of the day, the Commander-in-Chief is the Commander-in-Chief. And so it doesn't matter, kind of, you can say whatever you want to him. He's going to make his own decisions. I mean, then your only choice is to resign. And that is what Mattis did in the end. He resigned. And I think his resignation letter is pretty clear about the policy issues he disagreed with the president on. But you know, we'll have to wait and see what, you know, what he does in the future. Both he and H.R. McMaster, I don't think, will say anything publicly about Trump while he's in office.
Mm. Peter, thank you for the reporting. Thank you for the insights, and thank you for your time.
Well, thank you very much, and thank you for the very in-depth interview.
The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Thanks this week to Peter Bergen for coming on the show. Please share the podcast with your friends and even people who aren't your friends. Just get in their face and tell them the Lawfare Podcast is for you. And remember to shop at the Lawfare store for your remaining holiday gift shopping. This episode is edited and produced by Jen Pacha-Howell. Jacob Schultz was our audio engineer, and Sophia Yan performed our music. As always, thanks for listening.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.